Namaste, everyone. Welcome to the Bharat Varta Weekly. I'm Roshan Karyappa. I have with me Prasanna Vishwanathan and Nirav Kanodra to take you through all of the important news and events of the week that was. It's a pretty busy week, I must say. We're going to be discussing some important bills that have been tabled for the winter session of the parliament, the INS Vela being inducted into the Navy, India selling about 5 million barrels of oil. Nirav can add more on, how that affects global crude prices and so on. Prime Minister Modi speaking about anti-coloniality, right? I mean, again, something quite unusual, and there's a background to it. There's also an Omicron variant of COVID out in the world, and that is causing some concern. And finally, in the world of politics, Mamata Banerjee of the TMC has been positioned as a prime ministerial candidate for potential prime ministerial candidate for 2024. So lots to discuss. Hey Prasanna, hey Nirav.
Hello.
How are you guys doing?
All well, sir. All well.
Yeah, lovely Sunday morning in Bangalore. It feels like Ooty here, actually.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Great weather.
Yeah, fantastic.
Mumbai is hot and humid still. It's still end of November.
Oh, yeah. Really? Okay. Hopefully it cools down. So last week we had a couple of interesting episodes. I spoke to Ashish, who is a longtime friend of the podcast. He's been away on government duty. He's been since nominated as a counselor to the permanent mission of India to the WTO, and so we have a man on the inside, right? So he took us through some of the inside perspectives on how the government functions and policy making, how public discourse affects some of this and the various nuances of this. We had also earlier covered policy making with Ashish in a special episode last year, if I remember correctly. This was a nice extension to that because of course over the last 3 months he has an insider's perspective on this. And, he's also getting to interact with a lot of global delegates and so on. So it was interesting to, note their optimism for India, actually. So a lot of positivity on that front. Do check out this short 30-minute episode with Ashish. I think it's very interesting. Nirav, what did you think about Vaibhav's episode about COP26?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So it was like quite interesting in terms of breaking down the in-between path. So the big announcement is India would reach zero carbon emissions, net zero by 2070. But how do we reach there? And how we grow from here as the economy grows, so our emissions also grow till it reaches a inflection point and we start reducing it. Also, he discussed a lot of international policy like stock versus flow, where the stock is mostly due to the Western nations having polluted in the 20th century, but the current bigger polluters are the Asian nations, China being the biggest. And he also spoke about a very interesting part about what is like local pollution versus global climate change, because localized pollution like stubble burning has like different solutions, but global issues like China burning coal could see like polar glaciers melting, etc. Right, so very well nuanced, very well differentiated, and we spoke a lot about like length and breadth of like climate policy, including technologies like green hydrogen, EVs. So it's quite a comprehensive episode, definitely worth a listen.
Yeah, for sure. So two very good episodes last week. Do check it out if you haven't. Starting with the first piece of news, the winter session of the parliament is coming up and there are some important bills that will be tabled this time. These include the Data Protection Bill 2021, Regulation of Official Digital Currency Bill, the Cryptocurrency and Regulation of Official Digital Currency Bill, and more. The government has listed as many as 26 bills for the introduction in parliament during this session, which is supposed to take place between November 29th and December 23rd. The cryptocurrency bill will seek to prohibit all private cryptocurrencies in India. However, it allows for certain exceptions to promote the underlying technology of cryptocurrency. Nirav, a lot of anticipation, especially on the crypto front. Right? What are your thoughts on what will happen?
So I think what they will say is that cryptocurrencies, the way they are called, I don't think any emerging market country would like to have a medium of exchange. So a currency is a store of value as well as a medium of exchange. What they will say is it might prohibit any transactions using cryptocurrency. So you cannot pay for goods or services using Bitcoin or Ethereum, etc. That might be prohibited because this can lead to capital flight. And what they might use it as crypto assets could be, so I'm not aware about it, but as per a lot of discussions, it could be treated as a commodity asset or a store of value. That like gold, it is an asset. It is generated using an algorithm which uses electricity. So it's a store of value and it can be used as a saving asset, but it might, the prohibition will be on any form of, as a medium of exchange. So you cannot pay for a cup of coffee or you cannot pay for an apartment or because a lot of criminals have been using this, right? So you don't want capital flight out of the country and you want a better record keeping of all the transactions. So taxation is not avoided. So I think that is what is going to be the core of it. The underlying blockchain technology that can be put to for many interesting uses, concepts of a distributed ledger, etc. So I think because any country wants to, any sovereign wants to keep the control on its own currency and it wants to regulate its all transactions which happen in its jurisdiction, as well as the ability to tax those transactions, right? So they don't want this capital flight out. I think it's a very sensible bill. People probably might be able to trade crypto assets, as in, as a, I would say, like maybe other private cryptocurrency as a store of value. It's the way you could probably trade gold or say diamonds or something else. But this is, transactions definitely would be banned. There are a lot of other interesting bills as well. So a few which caught my interest. So one, obviously the very big will be the farm laws repeal bill. Then there is the Data Protection Act. So I think as we keep generating a lot of data, as the mode of our payments goes through a lot of online payments, either UPI or other payment apps, etc. So how this data is collected, how this data is stored and used, or like a lot of credit card companies or payment companies are using your data and selling it to other marketing companies, right? A lot of people have already been getting like too many spam calls, etc. Based on your spending. So I think your the Data Protection Act could be very interesting. Another one which I really am looking forward to is like the Metro Act. So I think that is giving a flip. I think we are having about 30 odd cities already having metro coming up. So I think the country is focusing a lot more on urban infrastructure. So that should be very good as well. There are other ones such as the immigration bill, which allows for people to emigrate into India, which is not through the CAA route, but the traditional longer process of immigration. So I think that is being amended. I think there are a lot of people who are opposing, saying that, say for example, Muslims from our neighboring countries could not emigrate. They can emigrate. It's just the process is longer. So I think that one is there, as well as you have like the couple of bills on like maritime fisheries, as well as the anti-doping and the narcotics bills. So I think it's very interesting. As you said, I think the biggest one is the cryptocurrency. The next one is probably data protection. But it's a very active month from November up till end of December. So yeah, hopefully all these bills get passed through the parliament from both the houses without any major opposition.
Yeah, just to add on, Roshan, I think one other significant bill, not exactly from the digital landscape or the legislative agenda that Nirav just pointed out, I think there is a bill where in the 2002, I mean, in the 2021 budget, Finance Minister Nirmala Sitharaman promised that two PSU banks will be privatized, actually. So as you may be aware, there is some nationalization legislation that was passed in the 70s. Late 60s, early 70s by the Indira Gandhi regime, which kind of, you know, overnight the government acquired all private sector banks, actually. And that particular piece of legislation is needs to be amended to move forward on any banking privatization, actually. So I think the government has I'm sure internally it has worked out on which two banks are likely to be privatized, or at least they might want to, even if they're not proceeding with the specific privatization, they might want the enablement legislature to be passed, actually, because I think that's a very key step, because historically even the courts have stuck down on any privatizations that have been done without making suitable amendments. So I think previous session, the insurance law, I mean, insurance privatization was enabled by dismantling the old legislation. So I think this time that will be an interesting thing, because, you know, that is something, you know, which broadly constitutes reforms according to our, you know, I mean, which is there in the laundry list of reforms for the last two decades, actually. So let's see how that goes. That should be interesting.
Yeah, no, I think all of these are long pending, right? I think even the data protection bill, I think the what has been applied right now is, I think, IT Act of some 20 years ago, I think. That is what has correct, been. Correct. And even the crypto front, we're seeing so much of action, not to mention the ads and everything. And I think it's the high time that government steps in and takes a more proactive, you know.
Correct. I think like the details of the legislation are not out, actually. I think like just people and media are speculating just based on the title, the draft title of the bill. Okay. I don't think so. This is going to be like a very, a total ban, complete ban kind of approach. I'm sure it's going to be much more nuanced, and I think it will lean more towards regulatory framework rather than outright ban.
Exactly.
And like Nirav says, of course, certain sovereign, the right of the state to have the complete authority to print currency and have it as the value of money. I think there will not be any compromise on those fronts, actually. But I think other than that, in terms of, you know, maybe some regulatory framework for crypto exchanges and probably recognizing it as an asset class and maybe some taxation treatment around it. And, you know, maybe only authorized exchanges can buy and sell. If they can bring in that kind of some intelligent regulatory framework, that will be good, actually. I hope it's not going to be like one outright ban.
No, I think likely that it will be recognized as an asset and, you know, we'll probably treat it as a mutual fund or financial instrument, basically. Because that is also, I mean, I think it could be a source of tax for the government as well, right? So, all right. So plenty of interesting stuff on that front. Moving on, the INS Vela, India's fourth Scorpene class submarine has been inducted into the Navy. The Scorpene is a 2000 ton conventional propulsion submarine for all types of missions, such as the surface vessel warfare, anti-submarine warfare, long range strikes, special operations, and intelligence gathering. These submarines have a state-of-the-art sonar and sensor suite, permitting outstanding operational capabilities. INS Vela is the fourth of the Scorpene class, built by Mumbai-based Mazagon Dock Shipbuilders Limited, MDL, in cooperation with the MS Naval Group of France. Prasanna, what do you think about this development?
Yeah, I think it's been in the pipeline for long. There's massive prepping which is happening in the background. I think like there is a clear security situation that I think, you know, India is facing. Of course, I think it's being probably discussed in hushed tones as of now, but I think a lot of these long pending, defense projects are getting commissioned. So I think it's a recognition of the security environment that we are operating at.
Right. Moving on. So India is planning to sell about 5 million barrels of oil from its petroleum stockpiles as part of a coordinated move with the US. The volume of the initial release is about a day's worth of India's crude consumption, but its significance may be more symbolic. It shows major oil consumers are willing to work together to challenge the OPEC alliance's sway over global markets. President Joe Biden is preparing to officially announce a coordinated release in conjunction with India, Japan, and South Korea as soon as Tuesday. The US began lobbying major Asian oil consumers to tap their reserves after OPEC rebuffed requests to return supply to the market more quickly. Nirav, what do you think is happening?
Okay, so I think here I would say that US is releasing 50 million barrels, which is about less than 3 days of their consumption. So US consumes 18 million barrels a day. India consumes about 5 million barrels a day. The global production and consumption is about 100 million barrels a day, right? So what has happened is that OPEC is not producing more. And this has led to the large price rise. What is there is this reducing stock is barely anything like for US 3 days or for India, like a day's production or consumption. The solution would have been flow. And Joe Biden himself has actually banned drilling of shale oil on any federal government owned land in the US. He's made it more difficult for banks to lend to shale oil projects. So I think this is not solving the problem. It's a symbolic thing. If OPEC, the producers have a cartel, he's saying the consumers also should come together. And if they have their stores, they have stored some inventory, they should sell it. But the cards are held by OPEC, who has a lot of inventory below the ground, right? And they have these oil wells, they have a lot of inventory. They can control or increase production as and when they want. The chips that you hold are tiny because a country like India probably has just 7 to 10 days of strategic petroleum reserves. So it's not, you know that, okay, once you sell all of this, where will you go? A month later, you will come back to the table, right? So I think it's bargaining from a position of weakness. Again, oil prices have fallen not because of this announcement. It is because of the new Omicron variant, which is curbing demand, right? So demand has collapsed. Everybody's going to, there'll be going to be more mobility restrictions. You're already seeing Europe having like a big surge in cases. So that is what has happened. I do feel that this probably was a misguided move. These strategic petroleum reserves should be used only in cases of like a supply chain bottleneck or in case of war or an embargo, etc. Or when prices have gone up materially higher, I would say like over $100, $120 a barrel, etc. And if it's just a temporary spike, I think this is not a move which is going to make any material impact on any sort of oil demand and supply. But India also, probably Indian leaders do know this, but they want to be an ally with the US, which is part of the Quad. They want to balance powers. So sometimes you do give in something, but I don't think that this would have any material impact on oil prices.
Yeah. I think it's more to do with also the domestic political dimension in the US, right? Like the inflation is just soaring there. I mean, at 32-year high, and I think energy prices have virtually gone up 60%. So I think Biden's own personal popularity is hurting because of the energy prices. And I also agree that it is hardly going to push the envelope. Even at the margins, I'm not sure whether there is going to be any significant thing. But I think it's more political rhetoric because, you know, before the strategic petroleum reserve move happened, I think Biden went after the big oil, you know, which is usually the favorite whipping boy of the left of American politics, you know, saying that they've kind of excessive profits, price gouging, and then he even asked the Federal Trade Commission to investigate whether there is a price collusion and all that. I mean, and it's quite surprising because I think it was probably one of the toughest years for big oil, 2020. You know, in light of that, I think they clearly looked the political rhetoric unleashed on them. And also, basically, as Nirav alluded, I think it's also the Democrats' energy policy which is going to come back and bite not just the US but rest of the world. You know, on one hand, one of the first moves, like Nirav pointed out, was to stop the Keystone pipeline, actually, which kind of was very energetically championed by Trump. And all those regulations about fracking, I think they're kind of ideologically opposed to what they see as the dirty energy. Okay, and without achieving the transition to, say, the new technology or the new energy landscape, I think, like, these kind of policies is going to have tremendous ramifications, not just for the US, globally. I think the only other option other than all this that they have with OPEC staying firm is probably, you know, ban exports. I think during Obama's time, they started exporting oil to the rest of the world because, you know, like they were able to balance the energy requirements. So I think that might push, that might be much more marginally useful than probably either the strategic reserve or, you know, the rhetoric against big oil or other things that they are doing. So, but again, that again will completely upset the markets because, you know, like US is also an exporter as well as an importer, and there are several contracts that US companies would have had globally. So I think it kind of, you know, a sudden export of oil, ban on the export will be potentially very devastating for the domestic oil industry as well, actually. So I think like the options are very, very limited, and it's exacerbated by the fact that the energy policies that the Democrats are pursuing is not good either, actually. So I think it's a tough problem to solve. I mean, no.
So coincidentally, I think the FAME subsidies here have been increased by more than 50% for electric vehicles, right? I think that seems to be more of a solution than any of this.
Correct.
So, yes. All right, moving on. Prime Minister Narendra Modi, in his speech on Friday, called for an erasing of a colonial mindset that exists to thwart India's growth. In his speech, Prime Minister Modi took a swipe at developed nations that have been trying to persuade India to cut down carbon emissions. To quote him, if we talk about absolute cumulative carbon emissions, rich nations have emitted 15 times more from 1850 until now, Prime Minister Modi said. India has been criticized by several countries for the change promoted by it to phase down rather than phase out coal power at COP26. So Nirav and Prasanna, what do you guys make of this? I think it was a very different sort of a stance, right? I mean, Prasanna, what do you think? I mean, the Prime Minister talking about anti-coloniality. Yeah. There's a good connection, actually, between that and tying it to climate change.
There is a certain, personality aspect to the Prime Minister Modi's, public speaking, right? Like, outside the election or campaigning, he's very measured and not prone to any rhetorical flourishes or, you know, adopting a very confrontational zone. I think it's like just for him, elections are where you kind of, you know, go all out and criticize and all that. But if you look at his public articulations outside that, it's so guarded and extremely careful. So it in that sense, it was quite uncharacteristic that he made this very well-crafted speech, I must say. It was pretty evident that the messaging was for the judges on the dais, right? Of course, there is always institutional tension between the judiciary and the executive and legislature. But I think couple of years, some of the Supreme Court judges have almost it's almost become like an ideological fervor and zeal and not into the job that they are supposed to do. And my sense is that the recent provocation might be even the Chardham project in Uttarakhand, where the court seems to be extraordinarily willing to entertain the argument of the NGOs despite the security situation that we are facing there. So I think some of the oral remarks by the Supreme Court judges and all, I think which later even the president kind of chipped on saying that, you know, this kind of oral remarks shouldn't be made, right? So it seems like a very concerted communication and messaging to the judiciary. And they've been like, I think the message that the Prime Minister gave is that, you know, of course, judiciary is a very independent arm and constitutionally mandated to maintain its independence, but it can't be diverse from the reality and the at what stage of the growth trajectory the nation is, right? That's why he brought in this difference between India versus West and all that. And very concerning that, you know, I think like generally prime ministers and presidents are very guarded in openly taking on the judiciary. So I think it must have been something that would have reached a stage where they need to wield the megaphone in the public and communicate to the judiciary. So I hope judiciary listens to it, but I'm not sure. I think they're kind of, you know, egged on by the media, which is kind of ideologically opposed to the government. So there is a convergence where judges play to the gallery, media highlights them as heroes. And I think there is this entire conservative approach to lawmaking is completely out of the window. And we also have a danger of next Chief Justice, who seems to have, Greta Thunberg is probably his go-to person for court on environment, which kind of, you know, is a little frightening. So I think like government senses that, quote unquote, wokeism is now afflicting the judiciary, and there has to be a much more matured engagement between the two arms of the government, actually. So that's the sense. Between the judiciary and the legislature. That's my sense. And Prime Minister did well to flag it, according to me.
Sorry, Nirav, you were saying.
So on climate change, like as you mentioned, right? So what has happened is the Western nations got the Industrial Revolution earlier from 1850s, right? And that's when they started the first steam engines and the coal-fired power plant, etc. So like the stock of the emissions or bulk of what global warming is happening is due to the CO2, which has already been emitted and it is there in the atmosphere, right? So whereas if India has to catch up and industrialize, India cannot shut it all down. And what the West has done is they have outsourced all their emissions to China. So I think they have kind of like switched off their polluting industry. So your local pollution in the West is lower, but doesn't mean that global climate change has changed, right? So I think here it was the day of the, on the Constitution Day, where he mentioned that some of this anti-colonialism jibe that he mentioned was like a lot of judges, they believe that they are still working in Britain, right? And so I think that is what he has highlighted. With his clear communication, probably he wants to shift the public opinion that industrialization is important for wealth creation, for reduction in poverty, etc. And that is why we cannot hold ourselves to the standards what the West is holding themselves to. I think very clearly pushed that across, that certain things what are right for India at this point of time should be decided by India and not by the West. And it is by the elected representatives, right? So I think that was very clearly mentioned.
No, as it is, you know, there's a hell of a lot of political capital that you require to push anything through in India, right? I mean, you look at the farm law repeal, for example, classic it is, right? So such an obviously good thing, which has been stalled. And on top of that, I feel like, you know, as Harish Salve also has mentioned earlier, this is like trying to govern without winning elections in some sense, right? And the amount of condescension that some of these gentlemen have is staggering, actually. I think one of them recently, yesterday, I think someone quoted that, all the highways or your rural, roads can wait. I mean, let's protect. Right. As if there's a dichotomy between these two at any point of time. Actually, right. And
yeah, so like, for example, that was Supreme Court Judge Gautam Patel. And like the question what they don't realize is bulk of the country doesn't know the preamble or the constitution, but bulk of the country does use the roads, right? There's a direct benefit. This constitution, if it is that holy, in 75 years, there have been like 50 amendments, right? Yeah. So the constitution can be amended. So I think they live in an ivory tower. And that's why all these things which have been like mentioned is highlighting the same fact that there are realities on the ground and there are policies which are trying to improve the life of the people on the ground. And the constitution has been there for 75 years, but then there are not a lot of public facilities or amenities, right? And that's what delivers like a better life to most of the citizens. So I think that is what the legislatures should aim to do. So that's what it is.
No, I think fantastic speech by the Prime Minister, and I think more people at the higher levels of the government should call this out, right? For sure. So moving on, there seems to be a new Omicron variant of COVID making the rounds, prompting more countries to close their borders. The Omicron variant has already been detected in UK, Belgium, Botswana, Hong Kong, Britain, and Israel, sparking global concern and a rush to ban travel. many countries have already imposed travel restrictions on flights from Southern Africa amid fears the Omicron variant has the potential to be more resistant to the protection offered by the available vaccines. Nirav, this seems a bit like Groundhog's Day. I mean, we have a new variant out there, right? And people are again going to ban travel. What are we looking at?
Okay, so I think one thing that a lot of people are missing out is this variant has been sequenced in South Africa, but this could have mutated or have origins elsewhere. You see that at least 2 to 3 weeks goes by in before like this variant becomes dominant enough, and then that it WHO comes in and gives it a name, right? So even if you do travel bans from today, probably there are a lot of people who've traveled in and out from like South Africa, Botswana, probably to Europe and or like the US, and from there they could be traveling onwards, right? So that is one thing. Second thing is that this variant has about 30 mutations. So it is very, very different from like the previous versions. So there is a worry that will the existing vaccines have a good efficacy, or will someone who already contracted COVID, like the original Wuhan variant or the alpha, beta, gamma, delta variants, would they have immunity versus this Omicron variant? Another one is very funny that the Greek alphabet has 24 alphabets. And there were a few of those kappa, lambda, mu variants, which are mostly in Peru, Colombia, in South America. But because of like lesser connectivity to the rest of the world, they didn't become like very widespread. The next alphabet in the Greek, next Greek alphabet was nu, N-U. But that could have been saying as people would be confusing it with the N-E-W new variant. So maybe WHO skipped that. And the one after is actually XI, which can, in Chinese, you could say it's probably sounds like Xi. Or so maybe they've like skipped that. So they've skipped two alphabets here and now moved directly to Omicron. Probably we are not out of the woods. We are going to get pi, rho, sigma, tau, all the way up to omega, which is the last alphabet, right? So I think that's a worry. With all the travel restrictions and all of these, I think, yes, it is prudent to be safe. It is prudent to ensure all protocols are met, including wearing masks in public, etc. And hopefully we come out of this soon. Fingers crossed that this mutation, the vaccines that were the traditional vaccines which are given in India, Covishield and Covaxin, hopefully they do give some sort of an immunity, at least against severe cases of COVID. And hopefully a lot of people who have contracted COVID already are immune to it, or if at all, they just get a mild version. And so that there is not a loss of life or health to a lot of people. It is still early days. We don't know yet. The governments all over the world, what they've done is, they have stopped all flights from South Africa and other neighboring countries, from Botswana, Zimbabwe, Mozambique. But that is not that much. It is a lot of times, India banned travel from China, but all the variants which came into India came via UK. Because somebody from China went to Europe, somebody from there went to UK, from UK or the US where people came to India. So I think there needs to be heightened vigilance. Indian government has also kept a rule where they've kept the flight capacity to 75% from countries like Singapore, US and UK, which have some sort of a travel bubble and like on arrival testing. And they've put it to like 50% with some other countries and completely banned flights with Southern African nations. So I think it's worth monitoring. Shouldn't panic completely, but worth monitoring and keeping an eye out what happens next.
Yeah. No, interestingly, I saw a counterpoint that, you know, the media is greatly exaggerating some of the potency of the virus. And also, I mean, given that, you know, how this is being used to call for lockdowns, etc., and it favors what the left's position is in the US, I mean, I'm not very surprised that could be something to that.
Yeah, I think Roshan, if you really look at, I think even South Africa is quite upset with the decision on the travel ban, right? It's almost like they acted very swiftly, identified the variant, and also were very transparent in sharing. And then they get slapped with a travel ban, which which kind of the incentive structure here seems to be a little
skewed,
you know, kind of not encouraging this kind of a behavior, right? And surprisingly, I think medical professionals and the epidemiologists, and South Africa has relatively good institutional capability because of historic reasons of being in the forefront of fighting various diseases. Surveillance capability, testing capability is been there in South Africa, which is relatively a more prosperous part of the continent. Okay, so I think one of those medical doctors, she herself says that, you know, of course it's abnormal in terms of the mutations, but the symptoms are very mild actually. So, like, in fact, she pointed out the case of a 6-year-old person. I think there were the symptomatic presentation, I mean, the presentation was quite different from the COVID cases that she had handled it before, and so she flagged it with the authorities, and then the sequencing happened. But according to her, people seem to be recovering within 2 days. So I'm not very sure. It seems like a panic reaction. And I think the Western countries seem to have, they have the financial wherewithal and ability to go on repeat lockdowns, right? Like countries like New Zealand. I don't think so. They ever lifted the lockdown since last March, right? And they seem to be surviving well. I think the financial handouts from the government to the citizens are high. But imagine the livelihood consequences for so many others in the world, you know, including people from South Africa. And I think South Africa, December is a great tourist season, actually. I think a lot of European travelers come there for all those adventure and wildlife tourism and all that. And I think entire sectors, travel, hospitality, everything will be gutted about something which is as yet unclear. You know, maybe we'll be silly 2 weeks from now for undermining it, or probably, you know, arguing what we are arguing. But at this point of time, I don't know, maybe the the Western society, especially the leadership in some of the EU countries, and surprisingly this time Britain also, because Britain, at least in 2020, I think Johnson had some libertarian instincts to begin with, and then, you know, probably it didn't turn out the way it turned out, and he also seems to have swung to the other side. So let's see how this goes, actually. And
No, also the way to look at it is that it's not an interim issue anymore, right? I mean, it's been like almost 2 years now, right? And it was definitely justified going into lockdowns and, you know, tightening things up in March of 2020 or April. But given that a year has elapsed and we're seeing newer versions almost every, you know, couple of months or so, I think we need to figure a working way to deal with this virus, right? So. And kudos to South Africa as well, you know, for being so transparent and open about this and moving quickly on this, right? So, all right, last piece of news on this weekly. The TMC is positioning Mamata Banerjee as their PM candidate 2024. Following the victory of the Trinamool Congress in the West Bengal Assembly elections for the third time, the party is expanding itself in different parts of the country. The TMC has inducted two former Congress leaders and one JDU leader into the party fold. They have also been able to successfully induct about 12 out of the 17 Congress MLAs in Meghalaya. They also said that the TMC has a larger strategic pan-India plan in place to take out the ruling BJP in the 2024 Lok Sabha elections. Prasanna, this was expected, I suppose, but what do you make of it? I mean, is there a real chance that we might have a Prime Minister Mamata Banerjee?
Yeah, I mean, you never know in democracy. I think everybody has a chance at playing out their ambition, and I mean, she has every right to go across the country campaign and, you know, convince enough people and elevate, I mean, and get within any position to be elected as the Prime Minister. That apart, I think I kind of see it slightly differently. There are 2-3 dimensions in this. I think the first dimension is possibly Mamata Banerjee wanting to ensure that she wins like 35 to 40 seats in West Bengal, you know, because 2019 was a bit of a setback for her. She was thought to be virtually unbeatable after her victory in the 2017 elections in West Bengal, assembly elections, where she steamrolled the opposition. And then in 2019, Bengal voted very differently, actually. So I think this time, partly it's to ensure that, you know, since she might be the prime minister candidate, so, you know, the Bengali Asmita equivalent will be paid out to consolidate and ensure that there is no repeat of 2019. Second, I think there is also the Prashant Kishore angle here, where probably his strategy seems to be using TMC's geographic expansion and all these acquisitions, this collection of freelance individuals and ideologues across the stream into the party as a bargaining chip with Congress, actually. So tomorrow, I think, like, see, if you really look at it, I think he's done work with Jagan Reddy, then he's done work with Mamata Banerjee. Maybe tomorrow Sharad Pawar could also be his client. So I think, like, this, he's trying to negotiate a block of Congress breakaway groups and go to the table with the Congress rather than they merging and kind of, you know, losing out their negotiation clout. So I think Mamata is kind of being front-ended for this project, actually. So I think if this block say wins around 100, 120 seats, Mamata is kind of having a better bargaining capacity in a post-election coalition. That could be one possibility. And maybe you never know, you know, Mamata herself thinks that she's transformed Bengal into a miracle state, and so she wants to replicate it nationally, you know. Like, I mean, you have to credit politicians. I think, you know, like, what we think is delusional at this point of time, it could turn out to be a very smart political move 2 years or 3 years from now. But the last point is that the only thing that will go essentially against Mamata is that she's a street fighter, and, you know, she is that. But her governance capability is pretty well known. You know, she has no track record when it comes to governance, which even the people of Bengal would largely acknowledge. You know, I think Bengal, the way in which politics rolls is that if a particular political party entrenches in power, then there is no differentiation between the state and the society. They almost take over, the state and the society dissolves into one single unitary, and it's very difficult to dislodge a political party from power. It's almost like, you know, left was in power for 3 decades. I think she's going to be in power for 2 decades. So it's more a political inertia or a model of that society, actually, you know. So it's not essentially anything related to the governance aspect of it. It's the way that the political society and economy of Bengal is organized. So there's no governance per se. I think, like, I think the first two reasons is what I would think she might want to be in a position to bargain. And see, TMC is not going to win. I mean, let's assume that, like, it acquires all the parties possible in India. Still, it is never going to, you know, win anything more than 60, 70 seats pan India, right? Actually, and one way for Mamata to become the prime minister is some kind of a post-coalition coming together of disparate forces to keep BJP out. But in that kind of a thing, at least going by historic example, people don't prefer quote-unquote strong personalities to head that type of coalition. You know, they will just go for the path of least resistance or some personality who they think is not mercurial or who can you know, kind of operate with a background who doesn't have a political base of its own. So Mamata doesn't fit this bill, okay? So I think even in a coalition kind of a thing, it will be a challenge. One possibility is that, I mean, some kind of merger happens between TMC and the original Congress, and the Congress concedes that Mamata is the going to be the face, and Gandhi dynasty kind of retreats to the background or willing to play the second fiddle or something like that. In that situation, since Congress is a national party, it could happen. But other than that, in a coalition or TMC by itself, see it very difficult. And, you know, all these people who she has collected in the recent month, you know, Pawan Verma is like kind of an intellectual, but he's a freelancer, political freelancer, you know, and he himself has written in his book that Indians don't have any principles, including me, and it's okay if we switch from party A to party B in fulfillment of the ambition. Swami lesser said about him, the better. And who else actually joined? Leander Pace. Okay, he's a, I like him. I used to like his tennis, if not anything else. You know, I don't know electorally how useful he'll be. But I think the Meghalaya thing is a decent coup, actually. And maybe another state that we could watch out is Tripura, where you know, it's 70% Bengali population. If Mamta is kind of able to appeal to that, there might be some challenge. But I think all this Yashwant Sinha, Kirti, Azad, they're all like past that prime. So it's just that, you know, you could just be in the news for a day. This is the Prashant Kishore style of building up to be in the news cycle every day by getting someone or other, right? I mean, there's no political utility, optics, basically. So I think that's how...
Perception.
Yeah.
All right. Interesting times ahead. And that comes to the end of the weekly. So we have a couple of very interesting episodes coming up next week. We have a great conversation with Mr. Gautam Chintamani, who is an author, film historian, and he's written a very interesting book, The Midway Battle, on Prime Minister Modi's second term and what we can expect going forward. Excellent conversation. We recorded this a few weeks ago. We're going to be publishing it on Tuesday. Do check it out. And also another offbeat, sort of an eclectic conversation due with Mr. Shirish Berry. He's been an architect for about four decades, very widely renowned. He also made this interesting movie on urban spaces, urban architecture, and how it should really be a little more harmonious and promote social interaction and so on. So that will be very interesting to check out as well. Two wonderful episodes coming out. Do check it out on Bharatvarta. Follow us on all of our social channels, Twitter, Facebook, and elsewhere. And until we see you next time. So from Prasanna, Nirav, and myself, do take care, stay safe, and see you soon. Thank you.
Thank you.